This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Marley and Me, written and read by John Grogan. Preface: The Perfect Dog. In the summer of 1967, when I was 10 years old, my father caved in to my persistent pleas and took me to get my own dog. Together, we drove in the family station wagon far into the Michigan countryside, to a farm run by a rough-hewn woman and her ancient mother. The farm produced just one commodity: dogs. Dogs of every imaginable size and shape and age and temperament. They had only two things in common. Each was a mongrel of unknown and indistinct ancestry, and each was free to a good home. We were at a mutt ranch. I immediately raced to the puppy cage. "You want to pick one that's not timid," my father coached. "Try rattling the cage and see which ones aren't afraid." I grabbed the chain-link gate and yanked on it with a loud clang. The dozen or so puppies reeled backward, collapsing on top of one another in a squiggling heap of fur. Just one remained. He was gold with a white blaze on his chest, and he charged the gate, yapping fearlessly. He jumped up and excitedly licked my fingers through the fencing. It was love at first sight. I brought him home in a cardboard box and named him Sean. He was one of those dogs that give dogs a good name. He effortlessly mastered every command I taught him and was naturally well-behaved. I could drop a crust on the floor and he would not touch it until I gave the okay. He came when I called him and stayed when I told him to. We could leave him alone in the house, confident he wouldn't have an accident or disturb a thing. He walked beside me without a leash. Perhaps best of all, I trained him to pull me through the neighborhood dog sled style as I sat on my bicycle, making me the hands-down envy of my friends. Never once did he lead me into hazard. He was with me when I smoked my first cigarette, and my last, and when I kissed my first girl. He was right there beside me in the front seat when I snuck out my older brother's Corvair for my first joyride. Born with the curse of uncertain lineage, he was one of the tens of thousands of unwanted dogs in America. Yet by some stroke of almost providential good fortune, he became wanted. He came into my life and I into his, and in the process, he gave me the childhood every kid deserves. The love affair lasted 14 years, and by the time he died, I was no longer the little boy who had brought him home on that summer day. I was a man out of college and working across the state in my first real job. My parents, by then retired, called to break the bad news to me. My mother would later tell me, "In 50 years of marriage, I've only seen your father cry twice. The first time was when we lost Mary Ann, my sister who was stillborn. The second time was the day Sean died." Saint Sean of my childhood. He was a perfect dog. At least that's how I will always remember him. It was Sean who set the standard by which I would judge all other dogs to come. Chapter 1. And Puppy Makes 3. We were young, we were in love, we were rollicking in those sublime early days of marriage when life seemed about as good as life can get. We could not leave well enough alone. And so on a January evening in 1991, my wife of 15 months and I ate a quick dinner together and headed off to answer a classified ad in the Palm Beach Post. Why we were doing this, I wasn't quite sure. A few weeks earlier, I had awoken just after dawn to find Jenny sitting in her bathrobe at the glass table on the screen porch of our little bungalow, bent over the newspaper with a pen in her hand. There was nothing unusual about the scene. Not only was the Palm Beach Post our local paper, it was also the source of half our household income. We were a two-newspaper couple. Jenny worked as a feature writer in the post-accent section. I was a news reporter at the competing paper in the area, the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, based an hour south in Fort Lauderdale. We began every morning poring over the newspapers, seeing how our stories were played and how they stacked up to the competition. But on this morning, Jenny's nose was in the classified section. When I stepped closer, I saw she was feverishly circling beneath the heading, Pets, Dogs. Ah, I said in that new husband, still treading gently voice, is there something I should know? It's that dumb plant, the one we killed. The one we killed? I wasn't about to press the point, but for the record, it was the plant that I bought and she killed. I had surprised her with it one night, a lovely large Diefenbachia with emerald and cream variegated leaves. I'd given it to her for no reason other than to say, isn't married life great? She had adored both the gesture and the plant, and promptly went on to nurture the poor thing to death. Working on the assumption that all living things require water, but apparently forgetting that they also need air, she began flooding the Diefenbachia on a daily basis. The sicker the plant got, the more she doused it, until finally it just kind of melted into an oozing heap. I looked at its limp skeleton in the pot by the window and thought, man, someone who believes in omens could have a field day with this one. Now here she was, somehow making the cosmic leap of logic from dead flora in a pot to living fauna in the pet classifieds. Kill a plant, buy a puppy. I looked more closely at the newspaper in front of her and saw that one ad in particular seemed to have caught her fancy. She had drawn three fat red stars beside it. It read, Lab, Puppies, Yellow, AKC Purebred, All Shots, Parents on Premises. So, can you run this plant pet thing by me one more time? You know, I tried so hard and look what happened. I can't even keep a stupid house plant alive. If I can't even keep a plant alive, how am I ever going to keep a baby alive? The baby thing, as I called it, was getting bigger by the day. When we had first met at a small newspaper in western Michigan, she was just a few months out of college, and serious adulthood still seemed a far distant concept. For both of us, it was our first professional job out of school. We ate a lot of pizza, drank a lot of beer, and gave exactly zero thought to the possibility of someday being anything other than young, single, unfettered consumers of pizza and beer. But years passed. We had barely begun dating when various job opportunities and a one-year postgraduate program for me pulled us in different directions across the eastern United States. By the time we both landed together in South Florida and tied the knot, she was nearly 30. Her friends were having babies. That once seemingly eternal window of procreative opportunity was slowly lowering. I leaned over her from behind, wrapped my arms around her shoulders, and kissed the top of her head. It's okay. But I had to admit, she raised a good question. Neither of us had ever really nurtured a thing in our lives. A little smile broke out on Jenny's face. I thought maybe a dog would be good practice. As we drove through the darkness, heading northwest out of town where the suburbs of West Palm Beach fade into sprawling country properties, I thought through our decision to bring home a dog. It was a huge responsibility, especially for two people with full-time jobs. Yet we knew what we were in for. We'd both grown up with dogs and loved them immensely. I'd had St. Sean, and Jenny had had St. Winnie, her family's beloved English setter. When we were dating, long before children ever came on our radar, we spent hours discussing our childhood pets, how much we missed them, and how we longed someday, once we had a house to call our own and some stability in our lives, to own a dog again. Now we had both. We were together in a place we did not plan to leave anytime soon, and we had a house to call our very own. It was a perfect little house on a perfect little quarter-acre fenced lot, just right for a dog. And the location was just right, too, a funky city neighborhood 1.5 blocks off the intercoastal waterway separating West Palm Beach from the rarefied mansions of Palm Beach. At the foot of our street, Churchill Road, a linear green park and paved trail stretched for miles along the waterfront. It was ideal for jogging and bicycling and rollerblading, and more than anything, for walking a dog. The house was built in the 1950s and had an old Florida charm. A fireplace, rough plaster walls, big airy windows, and French doors leading to our favorite space of all, the screened back porch. The yard was a little tropical haven filled with palms and bromeliads and avocado. Dominating the property was a towering mango tree. Each summer it dropped its heavy fruit with loud thuds that sounded, somewhat grotesquely, like bodies being thrown off the roof. We would lie awake in bed and listen. Thud, thud, thud. Once we got the joint just right, of course, it only made sense that we bring home a large, four-legged roommate with sharp toenails, large teeth, and exceedingly limited English language skills to start tearing it apart again. "Slow down, Dingo, or you're going to miss it," Jenny scolded. "It should be coming up any second." We were driving through inky blackness across what had once been swampland, drained after World War II for farming, and later colonized by suburbanites seeking a country lifestyle. Our headlights soon illuminated a mailbox marked with the address we were looking for. I turned up a gravel drive that led into a large wooded property with a pond in front of the house and a small barn out back. At the door, a middle-aged woman named Lori greeted us, a big, placid yellow Labrador retriever by her side. "This is Lily, the proud mama," Lori said after we introduced ourselves. We both got on our knees, and she happily accepted our affection. She was just what we pictured a lab would be, sweet-natured, affectionate, calm, and breathtakingly beautiful. "Where's the father?" I asked. "Oh..." She hesitated for just a fraction of a second. "Sammy boy? He's around here somewhere. I imagine you're dying to see the puppies." She led us through the kitchen out to a utility room. In one corner was a low box lined with old beach towels and filled with 9 tiny yellow puppies stumbling all over one another as they clamored to check out the latest strangers to drop by. Jenny gasped. "Oh, my! I don't think I've ever seen anything so cute in my life." We sat on the floor and let the puppies climb all over us. The deal I had struck with Jenny when I agreed to come was that we would check the pups out, ask some questions, and keep an open mind as to whether we were ready to bring home a dog. 30 seconds into it, there was no question that before the night was through, one of these puppies would be ours. Lori was a backyard breeder, motivated more by love of the breed than by profit. She owned just one female and one male. They had come from distinct bloodlines, and she had the paper trail to prove it. This would be Lily's second and final litter before she retired to the good life of a countrified family pet. The litter consisted of 5 females, all but one of which already had deposits on them, and 4 males. Lori was asking $400 for the remaining female and $375 for the males. One of the males seemed particularly smitten with us. He was the goofiest of the group and charged into us, somersaulting into our laps and clawing his way up our shirts to lick our faces. He gnawed on our fingers with surprisingly sharp baby teeth and stomped clumsy circles around us on giant, tawny paws that were way out of proportion to the rest of his body. "That one there, you can have for $350. Jenny is a rabid bargain hunter. I saw her eyes brighten. "Aw, honey, the little guy's on clearance." I had to admit, he was pretty darn adorable. Frisky, too. Before I realized what he was up to, the rascal had half my watch band chewed off. "We have to do the scare test," I said. Many times before, I had recounted for Jenny the story of picking out Sean when I was a boy. I stood up, turned away from the puppies, then swung quickly back around, taking a sudden, exaggerated step toward them. I stomped my foot and barked out, "Hey!" None seemed too concerned by this stranger's contortions. But only one plunged forward to meet the assault head on. It was Clarence Dog. He plowed full steam into me, throwing a cross-body block across my ankles and pouncing at my shoelaces as though convinced they were dangerous enemies that needed to be destroyed. "I think it's fate," Jenny said. "You think?" I said, scooping him up and holding him in one hand in front of my face, studying his mug. He looked at me with heart-melting brown eyes and then nibbled my nose. I plopped him into Jenny's arms, where he did the same to her. "He certainly seems to like us," I said. And so it came to be. We wrote Lori a check for $350, and she told us we could return to take Clarence Dog home with us in 3 weeks, when he was 8 weeks old and weaned. Just as we were reaching the car, we heard a commotion coming from the woods. Something was crashing through the brush and breathing very heavily. It sounded like what you might hear in a slasher film. And it was coming our way. We froze, staring into the darkness. The sound grew louder and closer. Then, in a flash, the thing burst into the clearing and came charging in our direction, a yellow blur. A very big yellow blur. As it galloped past, not stopping, not even seeming to notice us, we could see it was a large Labrador Retriever. But it was nothing like the sweet Lily we had just cuddled with inside. This one was soaking wet and covered up to its belly in mud and burrs. Its tongue hung out wildly to one side, and froth flew off its jowls as it barreled past. In the split-second glimpse I got, I detected an odd, slightly crazed, yet somehow joyous gaze in its eyes. It was as though this animal had just seen a ghost and couldn't possibly be more tickled about it. Then, with the roar of a stampeding herd of buffalo, it was gone, around the back of the house and out of sight. Jenny let out a little gasp. "I think," I said, a slight queasiness rising in my gut, "we've just met Dad." Chapter 2. Running with the Blue Bloods. Our first official act as dog owners was to have a fight. It began on the drive home from the breeders and continued in fits and snippets through the next week. We could not agree on what to name our clearance dog. Jenny shot down my suggestions and I shot down hers. The battle culminated one morning before we left for work. "Chelsea," I said, "that is such a chick name. No boy dog would be caught dead with the name Chelsea. Hunter. Hunter is perfect." "You're kidding, right? What are you, on some macho sportsman trip? Way too masculine. Besides, you've never hunted a day in your life. What's wrong with Louie?" "Nothing if you're a gas station attendant. Hey, watch it. That's my grandfather's name." As we fought, Jenny absently walked to the stereo and pushed the play button on the tape deck. It was one of her marital combat strategies. The lilting reggae strains of Bob Marley began to pulse through the speakers, having an almost instant mellowing effect on us both. We had only discovered the late Jamaican singer when we moved to South Florida from Michigan. In the white bread backwaters of the upper Midwest, we'd been fed a steady diet of Bob Seger and John Cougar Mellencamp. But here in the pulsing ethnic stew that was South Florida, Bob Marley's music, even a decade after his death, was everywhere. We heard it as we sipped Cafes Cubanos in Little Havana and ate Jamaican jerk chicken in little holes in the wall in the dreary immigrant neighborhoods west of Fort Lauderdale. We fell in love with his music for what it was, but also for what it defined, which was that moment in our lives when we ceased being two and became one. Bob Marley was the soundtrack for our new life together in this strange, exotic, rough-and-tumble place. And now, through the speakers, Marley's voice filled the room, repeating the chorus over and over, "Is this love that I'm feeling?" And at the exact same moment, in perfect unison, as if we had rehearsed it for weeks, we both shouted, "Marley!" I tried it on for size. "Marley, come! Marley, stay! Good boy, Marley." "Hey, I think it works," I said. Jenny did too. Our fight was over. We had our new puppy's name. The next night after dinner, I came into the bedroom where Jenny was reading and said, "I think we need to spice the name up a little." I had been reading the registration papers from the American Kennel Club. As a purebred Labrador retriever with both parents properly registered, Marley was entitled to AKC registration as well. This was only really needed if you planned to show or breed your dog, in which case there was no more important piece of paper. For a house pet, however, it was superfluous. But I had big plans for our Marley. This dog was the closest to blue blood I would ever get, and I wasn't about to pass up whatever opportunities it offered. Let's say we want to enter him in competition. Have you ever seen a champion dog with just one name? They always have big long titles, like Sir Dartworth of Cheltenham. And his master, Sir Dorkshire of West Palm Beach, Jenny said, and went back to her reading. The next morning, after a late night of brainstorming, I cornered her at the bathroom sink. "I came up with the perfect name." She looked at me skeptically. "Hit me." "Grogan's Majestic Marley of Churchill." "Man," I thought, "does that sound regal." "Man," Jenny said, "does that sound dumb." I didn't care. I was the one handling the paperwork, and I had already written in the name, in ink. When Grogan's Majestic Marley of Churchill took top honors at the Westminster Kennel Club dog show in a few years, and I gloriously trotted him around the ring before an adoring international television audience, we'd see who would be laughing. Chapter 3. Homeward Bound. While we counted down the days until we could bring Marley home, I belatedly began reading up on Labrador retrievers. I say belatedly because virtually everything I read gave the same strong advice. Before buying a dog, make sure you thoroughly research the breed so you know what you're getting into. Oops. An apartment dweller, for instance, probably wouldn't do well with a St. Bernard. A family with young children might want to avoid the sometimes unpredictable Chow Chow. A couch potato looking for a lap dog to idle the hours away in front of the television would likely be driven insane by a border collie, which needs to run and work to be happy. I was embarrassed to admit that Jenny and I had done almost no research before settling on a Labrador retriever. We chose the breed on one criterion alone: curb appeal. We often had admired them with their owners down on the Intracoastal Waterway bike trail, big, dopey, playful galumphs that seemed to love life with a passion not often seen in this world. Even more embarrassing, our decision was influenced not by the Complete Dog Book, the Bible of Dog Breeds published by the American Kennel Club, or by any other reputable guide. It was influenced by The Far Side by Gary Larson. We were huge fans of the cartoon. Larson filled his panels with witty, urbane labs doing and saying the darndest things. Labs were immensely amusing animals, at least in Larson's hands. And who couldn't use a little more amusement in life? We were sold. Now, as I pored through more serious works on the Labrador Retriever, I was relieved that the literature was filled with glowing testimonials about the Labrador Retriever's loving, even-keeled personality, its gentleness with children, its lack of aggression, and its desire to please. All this boded well for a pet in a home that would sooner or later likely include children. Quite by accident, we had stumbled upon a breed America could not get enough of. All those happy dog owners couldn't be wrong, could they? And yet the literature was filled with ominous caveats. Labs were bred as working dogs and tended to have boundless energy. They were highly social and did not do well left alone for long periods. They could be thick-skulled and difficult to train. They needed rigorous daily exercise or they could become destructive. Some were wildly excitable and hard for even experienced dog handlers to control. They had what could seem like eternal puppyhood, stretching 3 years or more. The long, exuberant adolescence required extra patience from owners. And then I came across the sentence that struck fear in my heart. The parents may be one of the best indications of the future temperament of your new puppy. A surprising amount of behavior is inherited. My mind flashed back to the frothing, mud-caked banshee that came charging out of the woods the night we picked out our puppy. The book counseled to insist, whenever possible, on seeing both the dam and the sire. My mind flashed back again, this time to the breeder's ever-so-slight hesitation when I asked where the father was. "Oh, he's around here somewhere." And then the way she quickly changed the topic. It was all making sense. I said a silent prayer that Marley had inherited his mother's disposition. A week before we were to bring our dog home, Jenny's sister Susan called from Boston. She, her husband, and their two children planned to be at Disney World the following week. Would Jenny like to drive up and spend a few days with them? A doting aunt who looked for any opportunity to bond with her niece and nephew, Jenny was dying to go. But she was torn. "I won't be here to bring little Marley home," she said. "You go," I told her. "I'll get the dog and have him all settled in and waiting for you when you get back." I tried to sound nonchalant, but secretly I was overjoyed at the prospect of having the new puppy all to myself for a few days of uninterrupted male bonding. He was to be our joint project, both of ours equally, but I never believed a dog could answer to two masters, and if there could be only one alpha leader in the household hierarchy, I wanted it to be me. This little 3-day run would give me a head start. A week later, Jenny left for Orlando. That evening after work, a Friday, I returned to the breeder's house to fetch the new addition to our lives. When Lori brought my new dog out from the back of the house, I gasped audibly. The tiny, fuzzy puppy we had picked out 3 weeks earlier had more than doubled in size. He came barreling at me and ran headfirst into my ankles, collapsing in a pile at my feet and rolling onto his back, paws in the air, in what I could only hope was a sign of supplication. Lori must have sensed my shock. "He's a growing boy, isn't he?" she said cheerily. "You should see him pack away the puppy chow." I leaned down, rubbed his belly, and said, "Ready to go home, Marley?" It was my first time using his new name for real, and it felt right. In the car, I used beach towels to fashion a cozy nest for him on the passenger seat and set him down in it. But I was barely out of the driveway when he belly crawled in my direction, whimpering as he advanced. At the center console, he wiggled and rocked and swayed, but he was grounded like a freighter on a sandbar, hind legs hanging over the passenger side of the console and front legs hanging over the driver's side. In the middle, his stomach was firmly beached on the emergency brake. Slowly, he began working his hind quarters into the air, his butt rising up, 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 tail furiously going, until the law of gravity finally kicked in. He slalomed headfirst down the other side of the console, somersaulting onto the floor at my feet and flipping onto his back. From there, it was a quick, easy scramble up into my lap. Man, was he happy. Desperately happy. He quaked with joy as he burrowed his head into my stomach, his tail slapping the steering wheel like the needle on a metronome. When we got home, I let him inside and unhooked his leash. He began sniffing and didn't stop until he had sniffed every square inch of the place. Then he sat back on his haunches and looked up at me with cocked head as if to say, "Great digs, but where are my brothers and sisters?" The reality of his new life did not fully set in until bedtime. Before leaving to get him, I had set up his sleeping quarters in the one-car garage attached to the side of our house. We never parked there, using it as a storage and utility room. The washer and dryer were out there, along with our ironing board. The room was dry and comfortable, and with its concrete floor and walls, it was virtually indestructible. "Marley, this is your room." I had scattered chew toys around, laid newspapers down in the middle of the floor, filled a bowl with water, and made a bed out of a cardboard box lined with an old bedspread. "And here is where you'll be sleeping." I lowered him into the box. He was used to such accommodations, but had always shared them with his siblings. Now he paced the perimeter of the box and looked forlornly up at me. As a test, I stepped back into the house and closed the door. I stood and listened. At first, nothing. Then a slight, barely audible whimper. And then, full-fledged crying. It sounded like someone was in there torturing him. I opened the door, and as soon as he saw me, he stopped. I reached in and pet him for a couple of minutes, then left again. We repeated the exercise several times, all with the same result. I was tired and decided it was time for him to cry himself to sleep. I left the garage light on for him, closed the door, walked to the opposite side of the house, and crawled into bed. The concrete walls did little to muffle his pitiful cries. I lay there, trying to ignore them, figuring any minute now he would give up and go to sleep. The crying continued. Even after I wrapped my pillow around my head, I could still hear it. I thought of him out there alone for the first time in his life. His mother was missing in action, and so were all his siblings. The poor little thing, how would I like it? I hung on for another half hour before getting up and going to him. As soon as he spotted me, his face brightened and his tail began to beat the side of the box. It was as if he were saying, "Come on, hop in. There's plenty of room." Instead, I lifted the box with him in it and carried it into my bedroom, where I placed it on the floor, tight against the side of the bed. I lay down on the very edge of the mattress, my arm dangling into the box. There, my hand resting on his side, feeling his ribcage rise and fall with his every breath, we both drifted off to sleep. Chapter 4. Mr. Wiggles. For the next 3 days, I threw myself with abandon into our new puppy. I lay on the floor with him and let him scamper all over me. I wrestled with him. I used an old hand towel to play tug-of-war with him, and was surprised at how strong he already was. He followed me everywhere and tried to gnaw on anything he could get his teeth around. It took him just one day to discover the best thing about his new home, toilet paper. He disappeared into the bathroom and 5 seconds later came racing back out, the end of the toilet paper roll clenched in his teeth, a paper ribbon unrolling behind him as he sprinted across the house. The place looked like it had been decorated for Halloween. Every half hour or so, I would lead him into the backyard to relieve himself. When he had accidents in the house, I scolded him. When he peed outside, I placed my cheek against his and praised him in my sweetest voice. And when he pooped outside, I carried on as though he had just delivered the winning Florida lotto ticket. When Jenny returned from Disney World, I saw in my young wife a calm, gentle, nurturing side I had not known existed. She held him, she caressed him, she played with him, she fussed over him. She combed through every strand of his fur in search of fleas and ticks. She rose every couple of hours through the night, night after night, to take him outside for bathroom breaks. That, more than anything, was responsible for him becoming fully housebroken in just a few short weeks. Mostly, she fed him. Following the instructions on the bag, we gave Marley 3 large bowls of puppy chow a day. He woofed down every morsel in a matter of seconds. What went in came out, of course, and soon our backyard was as inviting as a minefield. Marley was growing at a furious pace. Like one of those amazing jungle vines that can cover a house in hours, he was expanding exponentially in all directions. Each day he was a little longer, a little wider, a little taller, a little heavier. He was 21 pounds when I brought him home, and within weeks was up to 50. His paws were enormous, his flanks already rippled with muscle, and his chest almost as broad as a bulldozer. Just as the books promised, his slip of a puppy tail was becoming as thick and powerful as an otter's. What a tail it was! Every last object in our house that was at knee level or below was knocked asunder by Marley's wildly wagging weapon. He cleared coffee tables, scattered magazines, knocked framed photographs off shelves, sent beer bottles and wine glasses flying. Every item that was not bolted down migrated to higher ground safely above the sweep of his swinging mallet. Our friends with children would visit and marvel, "Your house is already baby-proofed." Marley didn't actually wag his tail. He wagged his whole body, starting with the front shoulders and working backward. He was like the canine version of a slinky. At no time did he wiggle more than when he had something in his mouth. His reaction to any situation was the same. Grab the nearest shoe or pillow or pencil, really any item would do, and run with it. Some of the objects he grabbed were small enough to conceal, and this especially pleased him. He seemed to think he was getting away with something, but Marley would never have made it as a poker player. When he had something to hide, he could not mask his glee. His body would quiver, his head would bob from side to side, and his entire rear end would swing in a sort of spastic dance. We called it the Marley Mambo. "All right, what do you got this time?" As I approached, he would begin evasive action, waggling his way around the room, his hips sashaying, head flailing up and down like a whinnying filly's, so overjoyed with his forbidden prize, he could not contain himself. When I would finally get him cornered and pry open his jaws, I never came up empty-handed. Paper towels, wadded Kleenex, grocery receipts, wine corks, paper clips, chess pieces, bottle caps. It was like a salvage yard in there. One day I pried open his jaws and peered in to find my paycheck plastered to the roof of his mouth. Within weeks, we had a hard time remembering what life had been like without our new boarder. Quickly, we fell into a routine. I started each morning, before the first cup of coffee, by taking him for a brisk walk down to the water and back. After breakfast and before my shower, I patrolled the backyard with a shovel, burying his landmines in the sand at the back of the lot. Jenny left for work before 9, and I seldom left the house before 10, first locking Marley out in the concrete bunker with a fresh bowl of water and a host of toys. By 12:30, Jenny was home on her lunch break, when she would give Marley his midday meal and throw him a ball in the backyard until he was tuckered out. In the early week, she also made a quick trip home in the middle of the afternoon to let him out. After dinner, most evenings, we walked together with him back down to the waterfront, where we would stroll along the intracoastal as the yachts from Palm Beach idled by in the glow of the sunset. Stroll is probably the wrong word. Marley strolled like a runaway locomotive strolls. He surged ahead, he veered left and right, darting to every mailbox and shrub, sniffing, panting, and peeing without fully stopping. He circled behind us, wrapping the leash around our ankles, before lurching forward again, nearly tripping us. When someone approached with another dog, Marley would bolt at them joyously, rearing up on his hind legs when he reached the end of his leash, dying to make friends. "He sure seems to love life," one dog owner commented, and that about said it all. He was still small enough that we could win these leash tug-of-wars, but with each week the balance of power was shifting. He was growing bigger and stronger. It was obvious that before long he would be more powerful than either of us. We knew we would need to rein him in and teach him to heel properly before he dragged us to humiliating deaths beneath the wheels of a passing car. Our friends who were veteran dog owners told us not to rush the obedience regimen. "It's too early," one of them advised. "Enjoy his puppyhood while you can. It'll be gone soon enough, and then you can get serious about training him." That is what we did, which is not to say that we let him totally have his way. We set rules and tried to enforce them consistently. Beds and furniture were off limits. Drinking from the toilet, sniffing crotches, and chewing chair legs were actionable offenses, though apparently worth suffering a scolding for. Still, for all his juvenile antics, Marley was serving an important role in our home and our relationship. Jenny's transformation from cold-hearted plant killer to nurturing dog mom continued to amaze me. I think she amazed herself a little. She was a natural. One day, Marley began gagging violently. Before I even fully registered that he was in trouble, Jenny was on her feet. She swooped in, pried his jaws open with one hand, and reached deep into his gullet with the other, pulling out a large saliva-coated wad of cellophane. All in a day's work. Marley let out one last cough, banged his tail against the wall, and looked up at her with an expression that said, "Can we do it again?" As we grew more comfortable with the new member of our family, we became more comfortable talking about expanding our family in other ways. Within weeks of bringing Marley home, we decided to stop using birth control. That's not to say we decided to get pregnant, which would have been way too bold a gesture for two people who had dedicated their lives to being as indecisive as possible. Rather, we backed into it, merely deciding to stop trying not to get pregnant. The logic was convoluted, we realized, but it somehow made us both feel better. No pressure, none at all. We weren't trying for a baby. We were just going to let whatever happened, happen. Let nature take its course. Que sera, sera. Frankly, we were terrified. We had several sets of friends who had tried for months, years even, to conceive without luck. Also troubling was a little secret from our past. In those blindly passionate early days of our relationship, when desire had a stranglehold on anything resembling common sense, we had thrown caution into the corner with our clothes and had sex with reckless abandon, using no birth control whatsoever, not just once, but many times. It was incredibly dumb, and looking back on it several years later, we should have been kissing the ground in gratitude for miraculously escaping an unwanted pregnancy. Instead, all either of us could think was, "What's wrong with us?" We were both convinced conceiving was going to be no easy task. So as our friends announced their plans to try to get pregnant, we remained silent. Jenny was simply going to stash her birth control prescription away in the medicine cabinet and forget about it. If she ended up pregnant, fantastic. If she didn't, well, we weren't actually trying anyway now, were we? Winter in West Palm Beach is a glorious time of year, marked by crisp nights and warm, dry, sunny days. We ate all our meals on the back porch, squeezed fresh orange juice from the fruit of the backyard tree each morning, and slept beneath open windows, the gardenia-scented air wafting over us. On one of those gorgeous days in late March, Jenny invited a friend from work to bring her basset hound Buddy over for a dog play date. Buddy was a rescued pound dog with the saddest face I had ever seen. We let the two dogs loose in the backyard and off they bounded. Old Buddy wasn't quite sure what to make of this hyper-energized yellow juvenile who raced and streaked and ran tight circles around him. But he took it in good humor, and the two of them romped and played together for more than an hour before they both collapsed in the shade of the mango tree, exhausted. A few days later, Marley started scratching and wouldn't stop. He was clawing so hard at himself, we were afraid he might draw blood. Jenny dropped to her knees and began one of her routine inspections, working her fingers through his coat, parting his fur as she went to see his skin below. After just a few seconds, "Look at this!" I peered over her shoulder. Fleas. Swarms of them. Even if they were slow enough to catch, which they were not, there were simply too many of them to even begin picking off. Of course, we blamed Buddy without having any solid proof. Jenny had images of not only the dog being infested, but our entire home, too. She grabbed her car keys and ran out the door. A half hour later, she was back with a bag filled with flea baths and flea powders and flea sprays and flea foams and flea dips. There was a special comb designed to remove insect eggs. She was back in assassin mode, this time to protect her loved ones, and she meant business. She scrubbed Marley in the laundry tub using special soaps. She then mixed up the dip and poured it over him until every inch of him was saturated. As he was drying in the garage, smelling like a miniature Dow chemical plant, Jenny vacuumed furiously, floors, walls, carpets, curtains, upholstery. And then she sprayed. You think we nailed the little buggers? I asked when we were finally finished. I think we did, she said. We checked Marley daily, peering between his toes, under his ears, beneath his tail. We could find no signs of a flea anywhere. We had annihilated the enemy. Chapter 5. The Test Strip. A few weeks later, we were in bed reading when Jenny closed her book. It's probably nothing. What's probably nothing? My period's late. She had my attention. Your period? It is? That happens sometimes, but it's been over a week, and I've been feeling weird, too, like I have a low-level stomach flu or something. I wasn't going to mention it, but she also had been rather cranky lately. I almost didn't say anything, just in case, you know, I don't want to jinx us. That's when I realized just how important this was to her, and to me, too. Somehow, parenthood had snuck up on us. We were ready for a baby. We lay there side by side for a long while, saying nothing, looking straight ahead. "We're never going to fall asleep," I finally said. "The suspense is killing me," she admitted. The pharmacy was open till midnight, and I waited in the car with Marley while Jenny ran in. There are some things guys just are not meant to shop for, and home pregnancy tests come pretty close to the top of the list. A few minutes later, we were back home in the bathroom with the $8.99 kit spread out on the side of the sink. I read the directions aloud. "Okay," I said. "It says it's accurate 99% of the time. First thing you have to do is pee in this cup." The next step was to dip a skinny plastic test strip into the urine and then into a small vial of a solution that came with the kit. "Wait 5 minutes," I said. "Then we put it in the second solution for 15 minutes. If it turns blue, you're officially knocked up, baby." We timed off the first 5 minutes. Then Jenny dropped the strip into the second vial and said, "I can't stand here watching it." We went out into the living room and made small talk, pretending we were waiting for something of no more significance than the tea kettle to boil. "So how about them dolphins?" I quipped, but my heart was pounding wildly, and a feeling of nervous dread was rising from my stomach. If the test came back positive, whoa, our lives were about to change forever. If it came back negative, Jenny would be crushed. It was beginning to dawn on me that I might be too. An eternity later, the timer rang. "Here we go. Either way, you know I love you." I went to the bathroom and fished the test strip out of the vial. No doubt about it, it was blue as the deepest ocean, a dark, rich, navy blazer blue, a blue that could be confused with no other shade. "Congratulations, honey." "Oh my God!" And she threw herself into my arms. As we stood there by the sink, arms around each other, eyes closed, I gradually became aware of a commotion at our feet. I looked down, and there was Marley, wiggling, head bobbing, tail banging the linen closet door so hard I thought he might dent it. When I reached down to pet him, he dodged away. Uh-oh. It was the Marley Mambo. And that could mean just one thing. "What do you have this time?" He loped into the living room, weaving just out of my reach. When I finally cornered him and pried open his jaws, at first I saw nothing. Then far back on his tongue, on the brink of no return, ready to slip down the hatch, I spotted something. It was skinny and long and flat, and as blue as the deepest ocean. I reached in and pulled out our positive test strip. "Sorry to disappoint you, pal, but this is going in the scrapbook." Jenny and I started laughing and kept laughing for a long time. Then Jenny grabbed Marley by the front paws, lifted him up on his hind legs, and danced around the room with him. "You're going to be an uncle!" Marley responded in his trademark way by lunging up and planting a big wet tongue squarely on her mouth. The next day, Jenny called me at work. Her voice was bubbling. She had just returned from the doctor, who had officially confirmed the results of our home test. The The night before, we had counted back on the calendar, trying to pinpoint the date of conception. She was worried that she had already been pregnant when we went on our hysterical flea eradication spree a few weeks earlier. Exposing herself to all those pesticides couldn't be good, could it? She raised her concerns with the doctor, and he told her it was probably not an issue. Just don't use them anymore, he advised. He told her he'd see her back in his office in 3 weeks for a sonogram. He wants us to make sure we bring a videotape, she said, so we can save our own copy for posterity. On my desk calendar, I made a note of it. Chapter 6. Matters of the Heart. The natives will tell you South Florida has four seasons. Subtle ones, they admit, but four distinct seasons nonetheless. Do not believe them. There are only two, the warm dry season and the hot wet one. It was about the time of this overnight return to tropical swelter when we awoke one day to realize our puppy was a puppy no more. As rapidly as winter had morphed into summer, it seemed, Marley had morphed into a gangly adolescent. At 5 months old, his body had filled out the baggy wrinkles in its oversized yellow fur coat. His enormous paws no longer looked so comically out of proportion. His needle-sharp baby teeth had given way to imposing fangs that could destroy a frisbee or a brand-new leather shoe in a few quick chomps. The timbre of his bark had deepened to an intimidating boom. When he stood on his hind legs, which he did often, tottering around like a dancing Russian circus bear, he could rest his front paws on my shoulders and look me straight in the eye. The first time the veterinarian saw him, he let out a soft whistle and said, "You're going to have a big boy on your hands." We were not the only ones to notice the transformation. We could tell from the wide berth strangers gave him and the way they recoiled when he bounded their way that they no longer viewed him as a harmless puppy. To them, he had grown into something to be feared. Our front door had a small oblong window at eye level, 4 inches wide by 8 inches long. Marley lived for company, and whenever someone rang the bell, he would streak across the house, going into a full skid as he approached the foyer, careening across the wood floors, tossing up throw rugs as he slid, and not stopping until he crashed into the door with a loud thud. He then would hop up on his hind legs, yelping wildly, his big head filling the tiny window, to stare straight into the face of whoever was on the other side. For Marley, it was a joyous overture. For anyone else who didn't know him, though, it was as if Cujo had just jumped out of the Stephen King novel, and the only thing that stood between them and a merciless mauling was our wooden door. More than one stranger, after ringing the doorbell and seeing Marley's barking face peering out at them, beat a quick retreat to the middle of the driveway, where they stood waiting for one of us to answer. This, we found, was not necessarily a bad thing. Ours was what urban planners call a changing neighborhood. Built in the 1940s and 50s and initially populated by snowbirds and retirees, it began to take on a gritty edge as the original homeowners died off and were replaced by a motley group of renters and working-class families. By the time we moved in, the neighborhood was again in transition, this time being gentrified by gays, artists, and young professionals drawn to its location near the water and its funky deco-style architecture. Our block served as a buffer between hard-bitten South Dixie Highway and the posh estate homes along the water. The neighborhood seemed safe to us, but there were telltales of its rough edge. Tools left out in the yard disappeared, and during a rare cold spell, someone stole every stick of firewood I had stacked along the side of the house. One Sunday, we were eating breakfast at our favorite diner, sitting at the table we always sat at, right in the front window, when Jenny pointed to a bullet hole in the plate glass just above our heads. That definitely wasn't there last time we were here. Most unsettling of all was what we learned about the small house kitty-corner from ours. A murder had taken place there just a few months before we moved in, and not just a run-of-the-mill murder, but a horribly gruesome one involving an invalid widow and a chainsaw. The victim was a retired school teacher named Ruth Ann Niedermeyer, who had lived in the house alone and was one of the original settlers of the neighborhood. After hip replacement surgery, she had hired a day nurse to help care for her, which was a fatal decision. The nurse, police later ascertained, had been stealing checks out of Mrs. Niedermeyer's checkbook and forging her signature. The old woman had been frail but mentally sharp, and she confronted the nurse about the missing checks and the unexplained charges to her bank account. The panicked nurse bludgeoned the poor woman to death, then called her boyfriend, who arrived with a chainsaw, and helped her dismember the body in the bathtub. Together, they packed the body parts in a large trunk, rinsed the woman's blood down the drain, and drove away. For several days, Mrs. Niedermeyer's disappearance remained a mystery, our neighbors later told us. The mystery was solved when a man called the police to report a horrible stench coming from his garage. Officers discovered the trunk and its ghastly contents. When they asked the homeowner how it got there, he told them the truth. His daughter had asked if she could store it there for safekeeping. Although the grisly murder of Mrs. Niedermeyer was the most talked-about event in the history of our block, no one had mentioned a word about it to us as we prepared to buy the house. Our first week in the house, the neighbors came over with cookies and a casserole and broke the news to us. As we lay in our bed at night, it was hard not to think that just 100 feet from our bedroom window, a defenseless widow had been sawn into pieces. Somehow, having Marley aboard with us and seeing how strangers eyed him so warily gave us a sense of peace we might not have had otherwise. He was a big, loving dope of a dog whose defense strategy against intruders would surely have been to lick them to death. But the prowlers and predators out there didn't need to know that. To them, he was big, he was powerful, and he was unpredictably crazy. And that is how we liked it. Pregnancy suited Jenny well. She began rising at dawn to exercise and walk Marley. She prepared wholesome, healthy meals loaded with fresh vegetables and fruits. She swore off caffeine and diet sodas, and of course, all alcohol, not even allowing me to stir a tablespoon of cooking sherry into the pot. We had sworn to keep the pregnancy a secret until we were confident the fetus was viable, but on this front, neither of us did well. We were so excited that we dribbled out our news to one confidant after another, swearing each to silence, until our secret was no longer a secret at all. Jenny's stomach at 10 weeks was starting to round slightly. By the time the day arrived for Jenny's examination and sonogram, we might as well have plastered it on a billboard. John and Jenny are expecting. I took off work the morning of the doctor's appointment and, as instructed, brought a blank videotape so I could capture the first grainy images of our baby. The appointment was to be part checkup, part informational meeting. We arrived at 9 a.m., brimming with anticipation. The nurse midwife, a gentle middle-aged woman with a British accent, led us into a small exam room and immediately asked, "Would you like to hear your baby's heartbeat?" "Would we ever," we told her. We listened intently as she ran a sort of microphone hooked to a speaker over Jenny's abdomen. We sat in silence, smiles frozen on our faces, straining to hear the tiny heartbeat, but only static came through the speaker. The nurse said that was not unusual. "It depends on how the baby is lying. Sometimes you can't hear anything. It might still be a little early." She offered to go right to the sonogram. "Our first glimpse of baby Grogi," Jenny said, beaming at me. The nurse midwife led us into the sonogram room and had Jenny lie back on a table with a monitor screen beside it. "I brought a tape," I said, waving it in front of her. "Just hold on to it for now," the nurse said as she pulled up Jenny's shirt and began running an instrument the size and shape of a hockey puck over her stomach. We peered at the computer monitor. She zoomed in on what looked like a tiny sack in the middle of the sea of gray, and with the click of a mouse magnified it, then magnified it again. But despite the great detail, the sack just looked like an empty, shapeless sock to us. Where were the little arms and legs the pregnancy book said would be formed by 10 weeks? Where was the tiny head? Where was the beating heart? Jenny, her neck craned sideways to see the screen, was still brimming with anticipation, and asked the nurse with a little nervous laugh, "Is there anything in there?" I looked up to catch Essie's face, and I knew the answer was the one we did not want to hear. Suddenly I realized why she hadn't been saying anything as she kept clicking up the magnification. She answered Jenny in a controlled voice, "Not what you'd expect to see at 10 weeks. I put my hand on Jenny's knee. We both continued staring at the blob on the screen as though we could will it to life. "Jenny, I think we have a problem here," Essie said. "Let me get Dr. Sherman." As we waited in silence, I learned what people mean when they describe the swarm of locusts that